Well, welcome back one and all. We've arrived at lecture number 22, photogrammetry and air photos for mapping. And if you remember, we talked a little bit a couple of weeks ago about the importance of photography as a base for doing mapping. Today I want to take a little bit more different tack. I'm going to review the role that aerial photography has played in cartography and in mapping, and it's been some very important developments over time. We'll look at those. But then I want to pick up the theme of air photo interpretation, sort of the other side. What do you do when you have the photos, and how do you use them in mapping? We looked at last time in how you would do photogrammetry and get measurements directly from photos to see things like parallax, to get stereo. Now I want to look more at what the content is and how you would extract features from the images and use those for different purposes in mapping. Okay? So we'll cover photography and air photos for mapping today. All right, start with some simple definitions, just to make it absolutely clear. Photography is the art or process of producing images on a sensitized surface by the action of light or other radiant energy. And the reason we have to have such a vague definition is that for a very long time, photography meant taking photographs. That was using the property of silver halides as embedded in film to be exposed to light differentially and then become permanently changed sufficient that they left an image, a latent image into the surface that could then be reproduced. But digital photography, of course, has changed this game completely. And I'll just point out that digital photography largely came about because of some of the things that I'm going to be talking about today. So now we use this term image rather than photograph in most contexts. So an image is a reproduction or imitation of the form of a view of objects. We no longer say that it represents the light because we can sense now pretty much anywhere in the electromagnetic spectrum. So we can take a thermal print and make an image of it, and that becomes an image. The art and science of photo interpretation is the act of examining aerial photographs and images for the purpose of identifying objects and judging their significance. And this takes place in two contexts in cartography. One is, can we simply identify things to then put onto our maps? And then secondly, can we use the imagery that we have to sort of make conclusions or to extract evidence from the images that we can then use to useful things in terms of cartography and intelligence? And I'll talk about that in just a second. So the science that goes along with this, we've been talking quite a bit about cartometry. The science of measurement that goes along with this is photogrammetry, and that is either the science or the art of obtaining reliable measurements by means of photography. And we've reviewed already some of the means that we can do that, like measuring radial displacement and displacement of the same image in stereo, same building in different stereo images. So we'll take a little glimpse back through history. If we go back to the origins of photography, they go back very much further, but still within the 19th century. It wasn't until 1858 that anyone thought to take a camera up in the air. And the original guy was this guy. His name was Gaspar Félix Tournechamp, but he chose the name of Nadar. That was his sort of stage name, I guess, and we still use that when we talk about the nadir of an image. We're paying homage to Nadar. So he went up in a captive balloon over Paris, up to an altitude of 1,200 feet. He took a whole series of photographs, of which these are two photographs, and those were a sensation. People couldn't believe how fascinating they were and how much detail they could show. So here we see the bottom of the Ile de la Cité in France and in Paris. And here we've actually taken an image and annotated it with street names and labeled the parks and so on. So here we're doing not only the first aerial photography, we're doing the first aerial photographic interpretation at the same time. Throughout the latter part now of the 19th century, Germans primarily began to experiment with aerial photographs and photogrammetric techniques for measuring features and areas in forests, primarily for forestry, and this led them to have quite a significant lead at the outbreaks of World War I and then later World War II. So right up until the 1950s, the best photogrammetric equipment that was available photographic equipment that was available came out of Germany. And 1889, again in France, again, Arthur Batut, that's him right here, is the first to take an aerial photograph using a kite of the village of La Brugière, France. And here's his view of the river going through that. Here's his kite. Curiously enough, there's been a reinvention of interest in kite photography, and quite a lot taking place these days. And given the low cost of a cell phone camera and the simplicity of slinging one together and putting it on a kite, you can really begin to take aerial photographs from a kite these days for just a few dollars. So it's really, you might say, we're back to the future. Well, the two world wars in the 20th century had an enormous impact on aerial photography. So at the beginnings of World War I, the airplane itself is still somewhat of a curiosity. The Army, what was to become the Air Force, was then still part of the Army. Indeed, it was right up until World War II. And as a result, there was very little systematically going on around mapping with aerial cameras at the beginning of World War I. However, by the end, what the British and French had learned and the Germans had operationalized was extensive trench mapping from aerial cameras. And here's a World War I vintage trench map where the topographic map has been used as a base and has then been updated from aerial photographs that were flown quite extensively. And this was perfected to such a state by the end of World War I in some of the huge campaigns like the Second Battle of Ypres in Belgium. Something like 60,000 aerial photographs were taken and then developed and used in the field pretty much overnight. So this is, World War I was really the era when aerial cameras went from being a gimmick to being something that could be used productively. Then we sort of went into complete negligence and forgot. The only occasional uses of cameras for mapping in the US were primarily in forestry between the wars. And it wasn't until the Second World War that once again went back and reinvented a lot of the optics and the systems for dealing with these. This was the famous K3 Army mapping camera. It was developed during the war that became the standard for mapping after the war. And primarily during the war, the mission for cameras was to accompany bombing runs to be able to assess the damage that bombing efforts had conducted, primarily within Europe. It was very quickly realized that an enormous amount more information could be seen on these photographs, in spite of the fact that they missed an enormous amount of useful information during the war itself. When we move out of World War II, the Cold War begins pretty much the day the Second World War ends. And during this period, which fortunately now is ancient history, the key word or the key phrase that comes to mind is denied territory. So during this period, the great communist giants of the Soviet Union, China, were essentially off the map. You couldn't really, there was no open skies agreement, there was no way you could go in and map the territory, there was no way to verify things like arms agreements or to look for troop movements or whatever. And so we went into what the so-called black world for aerial photography. And among the early developments was this plane, a remarkable U-2, a plane that is actually still in service, believe it or not, all these years later. It was designed originally to be a stealth plane, to not be visible on radar. However, they realized on day one that it was quite clearly visible on radar. And its only key to success, because it flew rather slowly, was to fly extremely high at altitudes around 85,000 feet. You know, where the sky begins to turn black. So the black nicely blended in. This had a period of enormous success in the late 50s through the early 60s. However, in 1960, this plane became embroiled in an enormous scandal when this guy, Francis Gary Powers, was shot down over the Soviet Union trying to gather secret intelligence. And captured and put on trial, and eventually was exchanged for a prisoner. Classic James Bond stuff. You might say the golden era for the U-2. Well, there were two. One was during the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, It was 13 days in October when the world came literally 1 inch away from nuclear war and was able to pull back largely because of the role played by aerial reconnaissance. You can't hide from aerial cameras that can come right over missile sites. But then the second great era was when the plane more recently was donated to NASA, was modified as the ER-2, the Earth Resources 2, and in this configuration, here it is flying over Santa Barbara, actually discovered the ozone hole in flights over the Antarctic. So it's been a long-lived and remarkable plane. Much of the imagery that it's provided has been quite extraordinary. But by the time Francis Gary Powers was shot down, only 6 weeks later, the United States achieved its first spy satellite reconnaissance from space. So this takes the aerial mapping platform and simply moves it up much higher. Makes it a lot more reliable, of course, because you can't shoot people down out of orbit. It's not, well, at least not until quite recently. Corona was a remarkable series of satellites. The program was started in 1958. It achieved its first successes in August of 1960, and then it was operational until 1972. And during its peak, there was a launch from Vandenberg Air Force Base about every 2 weeks of another Corona satellite. And they zipped off up into outer space. The operational module of them looked something like this. Here's actually the last remaining capsule that's intact. It's in the CIA Museum in Langley, Virginia. It contained at least in this version, this is the 1960s version, contained a stereo panoramic camera, which actually rotated inside the satellite. So it was continuously photographing long strips on the ground as the satellite was moving. But it was a regular film camera. It took photographs in orbit. It then the film from them spooled into the front of the satellite and was wound onto these two spools inside these two capsules. When the film spool was full, the capsule would separate from the satellite and would start to spin, and it would use gas jets to slow itself down. It would start to re-enter the Earth's atmosphere. This was carefully configured so that it would happen over Hawaii. And then a whole series of planes based at Hickam Air Force Base in Honolulu would go up into what they called the end zone, the area where it was going to be caught. They put these huge trapeze apparatuses out the back of the planes, and they would catch these capsules coming down on parachutes in midair and haul them in and then get that film to Washington as soon as possible. This went on for several decades, this kind of film return spy satellite reconnaissance. This imagery has all now been released to the public domain, so you can now get this imagery. But the principles, generally speaking, it was mapping with a frame camera, the so-called Argon camera, the KH-5, and the spy cameras, the KH-4, A and B, and could image an enormous amount of the Earth's space. The larger camera, which covered several hundred square nautical miles at a time, was a geodetic camera, so it was actually doing mapping geodetically of the Earth. The panoramic camera was giving detailed views. So this here's a little glimpse of our neck of the woods, taken by Corona in 1966. It doesn't look particularly high resolution, but at this time, the KH-4 A and B series were imaging with resolutions up to about 6 feet, 4 to 6 feet. And the imagery was so extensive that it began to be used by the national mapping agencies. And in fact, the EPA and the USGS and NOAA built what were called special mapping facilities, the secret classified facilities where they could process the corona imagery and use it to update the features on the topographic maps. So many of the maps that we've been using for class so far, the actual origin, the source of origin of those features were these spy satellite pictures. And that, of course, was not known to the general public until quite recently. Talked about the standard frame camera. This is basically how the country was mapped extensively for the first time, the classic 9-inch black and white series camera. We talked about the key elements, so there were frame numbers that would come off of here, reso marks, that allowed you to find the geometric center of the image. These were very much stamped mechanical and used for archiving the area that would then be updated on each of the topographic maps. After a little while, the USGS established what it originally called the National High Altitude Aerial Photography Program, or NHAP, and they pretty much took over the commissioning of imagery contracting state by state to update the topographic maps or to do other mapping. Here's some coverage of Wisconsin from 1954. Was it 84 or 54? It'd be about the right time when this was beginning. These 80K were very quickly replaced by about 20K for the 24,000 series maps, more detailed, with better resolution cameras. And obviously the spy satellite data got folded into this process. At the same time, the NOAA, especially the Coast and Geodetic Survey, were doing systematic mapping of the coastlines of the United States to get very detailed coastal coverage and for producing bathymetric maps and harbor charts. And they perfected a whole series of cameras, including this one. This was the camera that was used to image in multiple ways with multiple lenses at the same time. So this camera allowed detailed mapping directly beneath the camera at the nadir, and then more wide-angle lens views from the side. And then they perfected a mechanical device that could take all of the 9 pieces of film that got simultaneously exposed to this and project it onto a surface as an image that could then be traced over and used for making coastal maps. Now, this led to the idea of the fact that we could put filters on cameras. So if we wanted to enhance the red, let's say, or enhance the blue or the green, or even, say, the infrared, all you simply needed was a filter on the camera lens that would then filter the light and allow you to image uniquely in one part of the spectrum. This is an image I found from 1975. This is at Sioux Falls at the Eros Data Center, where the maps for the United States under the USGS were mostly produced, and where all of the Landsat and all of the NHAP photography was handled and is now archived. So here we have a classic clean room, but these are really just mass production printing presses for photographic products. So we were simply taking tons and tons of film, developing it, making tons and tons of prints, and mosaicing those together in useful ways, and then redistributing them. And the CIA had its own equivalent for the dark side of this. I visited this facility, and unique to it was behind the plant, they actually have a silver reprocessing plant, because processing film involves using quite a lot of silver halides, the active solution in developer, and they recycled all the silver. They re-extracted it back again and used it to fund the plant, which was kind of cool. Now today, when we want to do aerial photography, we don't have to invent a spy camera. We can go out and make a contract with a local engineering company that probably owns its own plane and probably owns its own photographic equipment for doing aerial photographs. So pretty much every community does this. Santa Barbara and Goleta both fly photographs regularly. The campus itself buys photographs on a regular basis and uses them for facilities management and planning and so on. I took these pictures at a recent trade conference, and was quite surprised to see that this is the aerial photographic camera. That's what it looks like today. It's pretty much exactly the same as that old army mapping camera, basically, except that it's all digital. And it's computer controlled. And what's happening here, here's another example. This device that's on top of the camera, so this is like the bottom of this, sticking out the bottom of the plane, is hooked up to a GPS receiver, and then also to a software console that runs planning software. So you no longer have to physically plan out how you want to do this. You simply say, I'm going to draw the area that I want photographed, and then the software will figure out the best way to have the plane fly over that area and where to take the photographs, and then it will trigger the shutter as the GPS reaches that exact position and record the GPS information with the film. So it really gives very good geo-rectification on the imagery And you might say all the photographic control that used to be done by processing the images after the fact can now be done sort of on board. This idea of geo-rectifying image is very much evident. It's all over the place today. So, you know, my iPhone here that has a GPS receiver in it and a camera, every time I use the camera, the GPS stamps its location on the image. So if I then down or upload the images to Flickr or anything like that, they come with their position already contained within them, so you can put them on a map directly. And that's very much doing pretty much exactly the same thing that's happening here. Okay, so enough about cameras and pictures. Let's start talking about what you do when you've got the picture and how you deal with it. So these are what we do, what we call photo interpretation. The first one is detection and identification of features, phenomena, or processes. So this detection means being able to simply see whether or not something is present on the image, and sometimes that's a particularly difficult task. Identification means that we can see what it is. You know, not just it's a white blob, but it's a car. That's a difference. And then not just features, say things that would appear on the map, phenomena, or things that are going on in the landscape. We've looked at some geomorphological processes, but we might be able to see whether flooding or erosion is taking place, for example. Processes, we might be able to see active or inactive processes, and I'll show you some examples of what I mean in just a minute. So we need to do detecting and interpretation. We need to do labeling, which means that we have to make a decision about what's going to be on the image and then put a label on it. These days, we just put a digital record, attach it to the feature. But in the old days, it literally meant writing on the image as an interpretation. And then a confidence assessment. So how sure are you about what the feature is and your identification? Or is it a misidentification that that can lead to problems? So it involves measurement and estimation. So a task might be not just to, let's say, measure the size of a field, but to count how many sheep are in it, or how many cows are in it, or how many haystacks are present. Obviously, the use in topographic and special purpose mapping, so we can actually see features that we're going to put on the map, like streams, boundaries, mountains, forested areas, and so on. We can use photographs for map updating, so we can say, let's just look at the features like, let's say, the road system, which we can see both on the old map and the image. And let's use the image to find the roads that have not yet been updated and produced on the map. We can also use it for problem solving, and problem solving often means intelligence operations. I'll show you some examples in a minute. So there we might be looking at object complexes, so perhaps not just a warehouse but a whole industrial district, or not just a golf course but a whole resort or whatever. Relations among objects, I've got some examples to show you of that. And then assessments and perhaps causes, and I've got some examples to show you of that. So these days we're all worried about things like, is Iran developing nuclear power capability? If we have spy satellites looking down every day, we can pretty much see exactly what's going on. For most of the Cold War, the CIA analysts dealing with the spy satellite imagery got to know every single car in every single parking lot for every single spy and industrial and military facility in all of the former Soviet Union. So they would know when somebody didn't show up for work because they were looking at cars and things like that. And then ratings of evidence, assembly of information. We can bring other information to the photograph to add to the content. So we might have other sources of information. And then rankings and assessment. If you had 10 things that could be an oil spill, which one of the 10 is the most likely to be a problem? So what is it that we actually do when we look at images and begin to interpret them? Well, we start down here with what are called the basic elements. So this is the ordering of image elements. We call these primary complexity, and they involve mostly tone. That's the contrast within the image that we can recognize with our eyes, and color. So our eyes are particularly good at recognizing color differences, although with some variations. As we move on to the secondary complexities, we begin to interpret the size of features, relative size and absolute size, so we can actually make size measurements. The shape of features, which becomes distinctive of not just process but also form. So we can, you know, if we can recognize a particular shape that might be characteristic of, let's say, an industrial complex, that can be very distinctive. And then texture, got some examples of texture to show later on. As we move on to the next degree of complexity, pattern, height, in which we might do stereo measurement of height of objects and begin to measure them objectively, and also the topography, the 3D form of the landscape, and the analysis of shadow, which can add all sorts of details about heights that might not be otherwise visible. For example, bridges cast shadows, and we can learn about the structure of the bridge by looking at the shadow when we can't see the bridge on the image. And then lastly, at the highest degree of complexity, we're making assumptions about entire sites. So, for example, what does this factory produce? We could tell by looking at what raw materials are brought to it and how the finished product leaves, what the size of it is. We could compare it with factories, say, in the United States. And associations, what land features are associated with other types of features, what things would we expect to be in the vicinity that might correspond. Okay, so let me give an illustration of some of those things that's a little bit more tangible. Detection, so let's do detection on a couple of levels. It's going to be Q&A from now on. What is this? Sand dune. Okay, so you've detected a particular type of geomorphological feature, which implies things like material. It probably consists of sand. It's obviously a wind-driven or an aeolian landscape. Anything else as we begin to look at it? No, not forthcoming. Well, as I look down here, I begin to see some darker blobs that perhaps make vegetation. What type of vegetation would I associate with sand landscapes? Well, it could either be scrub or it could be what's often called desert crust. So where you've got microbes actually live in the soil and they show up. Their chlorophyll shows up in images, but they're not necessarily on the landscape. If you ever walked on this type of sand, it's sort of crispy. It's got a shell that breaks as your foot goes through it. So I would expect that I might be able to walk up here, whereas I might not be able to walk up here, let's say. So I can begin to make deductions about the landscape. Anything else? Here's an object that's kind of unusual here. What's that? I don't know. But it's something anomalous, isn't it? It's something different from its surroundings. So I can make the conclusion that there's something worth looking at right here. Might be a person, might be a buried rock. Okay. Oh, good. This came out nicely. What is this? And the only piece of information I'm going to give you that it's in Sitka, Alaska. Okay, a pipe. That's a good guess. Okay, yeah. A cannon. You're right. It is a long-range gun. Okay, sticking out of a hidden gun turret. Okay, so how does that make sense? Sitka, Alaska. What's a gun turret doing in Sitka, Alaska? Sarah Palin. It's a telescope for looking at Russia. Now, don't quote me on that. But, no, it's this is actually a World War II vintage cannon, designed and then abandoned and left in place rather than taken apart during the period when we were at threat from Japanese invasion in Alaska in World War II. So this dates obviously from about 1942-43. Probably 43, I would place it. So just by simply knowing where it is and it seeming like a sort of anomalous object, by bringing other evidence into play, we can very quickly begin to supplement that. Okay, here's a process. What process is going on right here? Landslide. There's another human process going on here. Urban growth, okay. And so if you've ever, you probably just don't even look as you drive by on 101, this is 101 right here, as you pass La Conchita and the way through, it's the site of two of the most disastrous landslides in this region in living memory. When this whole hillside came down in the, I believe it was in the 80s, did this damage, and the whole thing happened all over again in 2005, I believe, and killed another 11 people. So This is what a landslide scar looks like. We can get all sorts of interesting things to associate with the image here. For example, this road, look at that, goes up here, and we can actually see bits of it in the landslide. Then it disappears and it continues on the other side here. So you wonder, was cutting that road, did that have anything to do with the cause of the landslide? Well, I won't make any statements. The lawsuit over this landslide went on for almost 10 years. This is a LIDAR image of the same area, and you notice that this slide, which is the one from the 80s, is this one here, and we've since had another slide. That one killed 10 people back in 2005 by burying these houses in La Conchita. Okay, so the process here, gravity at work, a human process, urban development, people trying to live somewhere reasonable with a beautiful view of the ocean in Southern California, and having to live with the risk of landslides, as many of us do in Southern California. Okay, let's do some inference work on process. Okay, you might say every picture tells a story, and I won't be revealing too much by saying this picture is probably in Wales in the United Kingdom. What the heck am I looking at? Yeah. Yeah, I know the area you're talking about, but tell me where you think is the castle on this image.
This image would either be down there or up there based on, like...
Okay, all right, I buy the logic, but I've looked at this pretty carefully. I don't see any human-built structures other than this dirt road on this image. So these are two features that are known in the UK as tors. They're just basically granitic outcrops on the top of hills. So these are hilltops, in other words. And this is a valley in the intermediate area. So let's make a specific question. What causes all these trails all over the landscape?
Critters.
Good guess. Pardon? Rivers. Well, there could be rivers, but this one flows both up and downhill. That's highly unlikely. You notice that all the grass is much sort of light greener here and in a few patches over here. Anybody notice these white dots all over the landscape? Yeah.
Sheep grazing,
you got it, yeah. So what eats a lot of grass and makes it look a lot greener when it starts to grow again? Cattle or sheep, let's say. What happens when sheep are dispersed over the landscape and a farmer drives up and dumps some feed down here? They all converge on one spot and leave it looking pretty muddy and all the grass eaten around it. So anytime you see these sort of natural looking paths into the landscape, the chances are they're not being made by humans, because humans are very organized about the way they get around. They make roads and trails and paths, but animals don't. They just simply go the easy way across the landscape. There are some streams here. This is, as I said, there's probably a road down here. So again, you don't know anything really about where it is or what it is, but you can begin to tell the geographical story. Okay, this one is interesting because it's about sequence. So what is happening in this image? Car accident? Well, actually it could be, but I don't see any evidence there of any of those cars colliding with each other. People without chains, that's the problem, I would say. What's the weather conditions?
Snow
and probably an ice storm, okay? Anytime you see a pattern like this, that's a car without much traction on a nearly level slope that's almost completely coated in ice, okay? So this is the front wheel path. They're trying to steer to get it back into the middle of the road. But the back is snaking all over the place. You can just imagine pushing this, the back of the car, going side to side. In fact, I'll bet this is the guy that pushed the car out. Okay, so we begin to see the sequence, the story. This side of the road is relatively clear. And then we have a median strip in the middle. And then we've got this side of the road that's full of cars. Why would that be? Well, maybe this is much less steep than this side. So the cars are getting stuck on an uphill side, let's say, or with a camber side to side, but not on this side. And then what's happened on this side? Well, look at these cars. These cars have quite a lot of snow on them. So these haven't moved in a while. Okay? They've been snowed on. This guy's cleaned his windshield, as has he. This guy looks like he's stopped and gotten snowed up a little bit. He got stuck behind and then tried to get out. You can see where he's trying to back up. So we, just by looking at the paths in the landscape and what's present, we can begin to put a story together about what's happening. Okay? Now, this is kind of a silly thing to do with cars, but imagine that we could do this with, say, geological processes or erosion and deposition. We're using the same kinds of reasoning in doing exactly that. Okay? Change detection is very possible with imagery. In fact, sometimes it's only possible with imagery. Okay? So this is back in March of this year, the Japanese tsunami, which struck and was devastating. We recognize this bridge as the common feature. It's still there. Look, the bridge survived. But as you can see, most of these houses did not. And the entire shape of the beach has changed. This entire patch of vegetation is virtually eliminated. All sorts of things have happened. For example, check out that blue roof building there, which seems to be present, but it's actually in a different location on the southern image. So we've actually seen buildings pulled off their foundations and moved around. Okay. By superimposing these two images, we can do change detection. We can look at before and after. And that's an extremely common thing to do with aerial photographs. You want to say, what's moved? What's changed? Has this area gone from this particular land use to another land use? Has a river moved its course? Has a slope failed and changed? Has a volcano blown? All these things are important to know about the landscape. And it's usually photography and imagery that's going to give us a hint to what's happening. So, word about measurement. Often the easiest way to figure out how big things are in an image is to look for things that we know the size of. Okay? And that often means finding standard size buildings, let's say, or roads built to specifications where we know exactly how wide the road track has to be. Perhaps we can find particular vehicles that we can identify, and we can then go and look up from the manufacturer what the length of the build of the vehicle is. But more common, fortunately, humankind has inscribed all over the landscape sporting features, and they all are standard sizes. All over the United States, pretty much at every single high school, there's one of these. And we know it's exactly 100 yards long, right? Because it's the nature of the game. We could also know that even things like the numerals or the heights of the goalposts, or even the things on the corner that you knock over when the guy gets the touchdown, we can use those for measuring vertical height as well as horizontal distances. So these are extremely handy. Now we've put a scale to our image that we can pick up and move somewhere else. I could take a piece of the image that, say, represents something that I'd like to know the distance of, drag it over and put it on top of the sports field, and I can see exactly what the size is. There are other ways to do measurements too. Orientation. We'd like to know how things are oriented, not only to the Earth's magnetic field and the Earth's grid, but also with respect to other things. So, for example, we're on approach here in a light plane going into the Santa Barbara Airport, and we're landing on runway 30. As we've learned, aeronautical compasses just have that last digit locked off, so that's the bearing on that is a true bearing of 300 degrees. So now we know the direction that the plane and the camera was looking at the particular time. It's often a difficult thing to be able to calculate. If we know, sticking with their airport analog here, within an airport, things are very much arrayed in a very standardized way, such that sometimes one airport looks very much like another. So we've got the main landing strip in the middle. We've got taxiways and runways around it. Often we have a secondary landing strip along the middle, but in this case, has been discontinued. And we've got several of those in Santa Barbara. We've got at least one major discontinued runway that, if you look back on the older, the 1940s vintage air photos, was a principal landing runway. Now it's been abandoned. Then the locations of terminals and buildings and gates with respect to the runways and with respect to the taxiways are very much given. In fact, we can even guess how much room we need to be, or how far we have to be from each gateway to each plane, and so on. So the fact that we can see planes on this runway, that we can take measurements, we can read off the numbers at the end of the runway, we can begin to configure this airport and perhaps begin to figure out exactly where it is. Okay, a quick word about spatial resolution. Spatial resolution is obviously important here. So this is four versions of exactly the same image at four different spatial resolutions. So let's start at this one. Here we have a 1 meter spatial resolution, and it doesn't particularly look that great. I can perhaps say that there are things here and they're mostly arranged in the same direction, and there are some things here that seem to be at about perhaps 90 degrees to them, but I can't really tell. There were fewer things here. If I move up to 50 centimeters, that's half a meter, I can begin to see the difference between a windshield and a car roof. I can see there's some texture here. I can see light and dark over here. Now I go to 25 centimeters. That's only 4 times better than the 1 meter. I can tell the difference between a truck and a car. I can see the stripes on the marking for the individual parking spaces, which are actually a good deal less than 25 centimeters. And then when I go to 10 centimeters, I can reach the point where I can identify the makes of individual cars and see the shadows and distinguish them and perhaps tell the difference between a Ford and a Chevy. Okay, so important differences in terms of resolution. Basically, the higher resolution we get, the better it is for what we want to do. It's always been said that we can read license plates from space, and certainly there's nothing in the atmosphere that would prevent that being possible. It would indeed be possible given current technology. Now, resolution is extremely important. This is a nuclear plant. I can't remember where, what country, but here it is as it appears in the spy satellite image from the Corona days, and this is as it appeared from the commercial satellite view. And as you can see, I challenge you to be able to recognize anything in that image, whereas you can clearly see that this is an industrial plant in this image. Now, the shape of things on the landscape is very distinctive. So if we can get used to shapes and be able to distinguish them, we can, again, learn a great deal about the landscape. We see these all over the Midwest, all over the Western United States, and we can immediately begin to say things like, well, they're circles, so they must be circular irrigators, they must have a central well, and a pivoted irrigation system that's going round and round, dropping water on the crops. We can actually see it here. Here it is in the field, dropping the long pivot that goes round and round. Why are they located in this pattern? Well, the farmers own townships and sections, quarter sections and half sections, so that they fit their irrigation systems up to suit their land holdings. So this gives me not only what's going on, but where in the United States. This has to be a township and range state. Here we see the same process going on, but here we're in Saudi Arabia, and we're seeing groundwater-fed irrigation in this location. They don't have a township and range system there, so they can put them wherever they are. So here they're offset to get maximum coverage within the certain area. And here again we have radial patterns, and true enough, radial patterns often involve water. In this case, we're trickling water onto the crop to grow it. In this case, we're trickling water out to get rid of the suspended solids in sewage. So we've got one of these plants just down the road from us. In fact, when the wind's in the right direction, you can smell it here from campus. That's treating our water and dealing with our wastewater for the entire region. So if you see one of these, and that's the way it looks here, then that's probably what it's going to look like in many other countries where they have this equivalent kind of setup for handling wastewater. By texture, I mean how do we identify the sort of look or the variance in contrast within the image, and what does that tell us about it? Here, if you look at it at one level, so here we've got three views of the Nile Delta in Egypt, this one from the space shuttle, and you can see that there's clearly three very different types of things going on here. This is desert, this is wet and arable, so there's crops being grown here, and this is water. Okay, so the three very different looking textures within this image. But then as you go into the structure of within this built-up area, you see this enormously complex pattern. This is Cairo right here. This is Zamalek right there in the middle of the river. You can see that the texture of the rural areas and the small cities which have grown up in this pattern patchwork pattern all over, form yet another texture. And then the roads form another texture on top of those. So recognizing the complexity and subtlety of this texture, again, is what image interpretation is very much all about. Pattern means the repetition of texture, so the structure within texture. And we can begin to identify what's going on. Let's start with the easiest one. What's going on here? A lower right-hand image. Fairly lush green. What type of plant is growing here? Trees. Trees, yeah. How are they arranged? Well, they're not particularly arranged, are they? They're at random. So this is old growth forest, which has had sufficiently length of time to come at a sort of natural random or stochastic arrangement across the landscape. Okay, let's contrast that with this. What is this? What's going on here? No takers? This is a palm oil plantation. Okay, we've got a regular system of distribution because we need to get in to harvest the palm oil and get out again. So we've got a network distribution on top of it. And you notice that the trees, even though they look fairly random, have been planted in rows. So this is almost like a field crop. Okay, these trees are palms, been planted for palm oil. Enormous areas of the world have been put into palm oil. It's probably one of the biggest impact environmental crops that we have. What's going on here? This is one of the most famous images of the last decade. I pulled this off of NASA website. Let's rephrase that. Guess the country where this came from.
India?
Well, bad. It's actually Brazil. And the land ownership pattern within the Amazon forests in Brazil is such that each person gets, along each road, each person gets a strip of land going the same width, but going back from the road. And what happens is you start by, if you're a farmer, you claim a piece of land at the road, you clear it and start farming it, and then as you need more and more income, or your family grows, you just keep clearing further and further back into the forest. So what you get is the road pattern embellished on the landscape, and this what's called a herringbone pattern, as each of the individual parcels begins to cut back, like the sort of bones of a fish, into the landscape. So most people would screech Brazil rainforest as soon as they see that one. Here's a kind of an interesting one. Let's have the two questions about this. What is the crop?
Coffee.
Not a bad guess. Grows on bushes.
Bananas.
They're taller trees. Okay, this is a tea plantation. Okay. Now what are the giveaways? Well, the size of the bushes, the color of the bushes, the fact that there are regular paths to walk in because it's all hand labor within tea plantations. But I can see the guys working on it. Look, these are people picking the tea. So they're in amongst their gathering the crop. Okay, we can take different types of... No more questions for a little while. Take different types of aerial photographs, and up to now, what's been highly favored is the regular straight down, or the nadir photograph, for mapping purposes. But the latest generation of aerial photographic data is coming back as oblique photos, and that's because of the rise of the drones, the pilotless aircraft, the Predator, the Global Hawk, and things like that can fly for a very long time taking images at different directions. So here we've got an oblique, low angle. We can't see the horizon, but we can locate where this is. There's the Santa Barbara Harbor. If we did the same thing in 1926, we'd get a very different view of the mesa, where the mesa was primarily being used for oil production, for oil mining at the time, and there were very few houses up there. And indeed, the marina hadn't been built fully yet. His equivalent, same flight, but further out in Santa Barbara. A few landmarks that are still there, Stearns Wharf. The California Hotel, that's in terrible disrepair right now. And this very elaborate open area here with a building that used to be here that's missing. The Pata Hotel, which burned down in the 1920s. And the only parts that are left are these elaborate sets of trees in front of it, which you can still see. Let's skip that. We can photograph in color infrared, so we can get information about different parts of the spectrum. This is taken with a type of film that allows you to contrast living and dead vegetation, so you can see the difference between the rigor and health of the different types of vegetation growing. Running short on time, so I'll skip that one. We can also go up to extremely high oblique, so this is a space shuttle view of the Mediterranean. And just thought I'd show you some of the campus photography, since we also do photography of the campus. You don't often see on top of the lecture hall over by chemistry here, but that's getting a little dirty. Here's a curious thing. This is the chemistry building, but it seemed to have fallen on the edge of two photos and got put together with different degrees of relief displacement. So I don't know what's going on right about by the main entrance there in the chem building. Half of it's in one direction, half is in the other. I want to point out there that X over here, this is actually one of the geodetic control spots for the campus. There are 19 on campus that are used for mapping. So being able to see those X's on the image is extremely important because they georectify the images. What happens when somebody's backing out their car as the plane goes over the top? Well, you get motion blur in the image. As we get away from nadir, we get all sorts of weird shadow properties, but we also see shadow on the lamp staffs here and so on, and here that we can use to make measurements. Here's individual people, what they look like from directly above. It looks like this is about to fall on them outside Corwin. Here we are on Goleta Beach, another one of the X's over there. These are individual people lying on towels. This is just part of the latest coverage. This year's imagery, I just extracted this to be able to blow it up to look at the lagoon. So I would argue that this is all extremely relevant today. So this made the LA Times, I believe, either today or yesterday. It's been all the buzz on the web blogs all week. This is at this location within China, in western China, in the deserts. Nobody knows what the heck it is. There's all sorts of speculation going on as to why on earth you would ever do that out in the desert. But look at that. That was put in the desert in Arizona in the 1960s when the Corona program started. So this is a resolution target so that you can to see whether or not these different size boards could be visible from space. So I would argue that you don't have to go very far to explain what's going on in China right now. Okay, that's it for today. We will convene on Monday. There's my summary. We will convene on Monday, but there will be no lecture on Wednesday next week. Okay?